Fleabag has a big meltdown at her godmother's art show, and then again the next day in front of the loan officer. Officer, why can't I say that word?
Hello, and welcome to Snark Squad Pod, the media podcast full of feelings, friendship, and snark. My name is Marines.
I'm Nicole Sweeney.
And today, we're joined by Marianne and Deboki.
Hi, I'm Marianne, and I work with Nicole at Complexly as the project manager over there.
Hi, I'm Deboki, and I am on YouTube at Okidoki Boki.
Marianne and Deboki are joining us this week to talk about the two seasons of Fleabag, presumably the only two seasons Phoebe Waller-Bridge has said that she is done now, and it ends in a way that it seems that it would be hard to keep going. As always, spoilers abound. We're about to do the synopsis, but I pointed out here specifically because I read a few reviews of this show and I found it really interesting the ways in which reviewers were having to try to talk around spoilers. Like, this seems like a really hard show to talk about without that, because there's not a ton in the way of plot, but there are a handful of reveals that recontextualize everything that you've already seen. So obviously, like, we're going to spoil the heck out of this thing. Fleabag is about a woman who is never explicitly named by the show, and Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who wrote and stars in the show, is credited merely as Fleabag. We start season one learning that Fleabag is a bit of a mess. She makes a lot of very reckless choices and does a lot of fourth wall breaking to tell us all the terrible shit that she's thinking and feeling as she makes all of her bad choices. Her mother died a few years before the series starts, and her father has since moved in with her self-absorbed artist godmother and become incredibly detached from Fleabag and her sister. Her sister Claire is one of the few characters who is given an actual name rather than just being named based on their like connection to Fleabag. Claire stands kind of in like stark contrast to Fleabag, as she seems very together. She's married and has a very fancy job and loves her sister, but is like incredibly wound up and struggles to connect with her sister, who is like clearly a train wreck right now, but also seems to have always been the more laid back sibling. As we learn much later, she is more like her mother, which likely contributed to her being the most alienated in the aftermath of this loss. We learn early on that Fleabag is dealing with grief from two losses, not only that of her mother, but more recently that of her best friend and business partner, Boo. The two started a small cafe together, and it's only at the end of the first season that we learned that Boo killed herself after Fleabag slept with Boo's boyfriend. We learn this in part because Fleabag confesses to Claire that Claire's husband made a move on her at Claire's birthday, but Claire ultimately sides with her husband because of what Fleabag did to Boo. Fleabag has a big meltdown at her godmother's art show, and then again the next day in front of the loan officer, who had previously been an antagonistic figure, but is moved by Fleabag basically bottoming out in front of him and decides to help her and like approve her for this loan. In season two, we jump forward a year and some change and find that Fleabag's relationship with Claire is still strained, but Fleabag is generally doing a lot better. She's having less reckless sex and her business is doing well, but in spite of making better choices, she still hasn't fully processed all of her trauma and is still struggling to connect with other people. In episode one, she meets the priest who is going to marry her widowed father to her artist godmother, and Fleabag and the hot priest develop a very flirtatious friendship. Hot priest understands Fleabag, and as their relationship grows, he eventually starts to notice when Fleabag is checking out mid-conversation to break the fourth wall. He never like sees the audience as she does, but he does see her in a way that nobody else on the show quite has. They eventually sleep together, but in the end, hot priest loves God most of all, and so they share one final scene together at a stop saying their goodbyes. Fleabag then also walks off in the opposite direction, this time telling the camera and us goodbye too.
Yeah, that is it in a nutshell. And I feel like hearing you sum it all up, it's interesting because this is, you know, a pretty short contained kind of thing and there isn't a lot of plot, but I felt like a lot happened. Mm-hmm. So I guess we'll get to that. But we'll start where we always start, with the question of whether or not we like this. So, Marianne, did you like it?
I did. It's weird to say this because, like, we just talked about how there's not much of a plot, but I didn't really care for the things that happened in the show itself, especially season one. Like, there's a little bit of cringe and second degree embarrassment that make me feel really uncomfortable whenever I watch it on TV or in any form of media. But I really, really love the concept of it. I love the way that it deals with all of these different themes about what it is to be a person and what it is to grieve and like when your personhood conflicts with another person's personhood. Yeah, overall, I did like it, even though the things that happened in the show weren't really my favorite.
Yeah, I think I loved Fleabag, and I had a lot of the same reaction to the first season too, where it is very reliant on cringe, and it was very uncomfortable to watch. But I think one of the things that helped is that all of that cringe, like, it makes sense. Like, it doesn't just feel like they're trying to make you uncomfortable. I mean, I think that is part of her goal, but it's not just the discomfort. It's like towards, I guess, a greater purpose in the story. And I wasn't sure how it was going to even work as a second season, but I loved the second season. I loved it like on its own. It's very different from the first season, especially in the context of that cringe factor. It doesn't really have that as much, but I especially love how it kind of like brings everything together and wraps things up, but like not too tidily either.
Yeah, I also really loved this. I was going to say more or less what Deboki just did in terms of the cringe inducing moments in the first season were always very deliberate. And I think every like moment of this show is incredibly deliberate. And to this point about like feeling like a lot happens, even though it's fairly short and contained, I think every minute of this show was used effectively. Like, there is no filler. There's no wasted space. Every beat is there for a reason, and including the cringy, uncomfortable to watch pieces of it. And I really, really loved this. I finished the second season and was like, cool, I just need to lay on my couch and like stare at the wall for a while. just sit in my feelings, because yeah, I was incredibly moved by this show, and I absolutely loved it.
I also loved it. Brand is strong, and I had planned to binge it this weekend, but I found that I needed to take breaks because of that cringe. And there were moments where I literally had to pause and be like, girl, no, and like walk away and compose myself and give myself a little space from the viewing because of her actions and stuff. But yes, it all felt very deliberate. And I think that the show did a very good job balancing like her more destructive behavior with sympathy and empathy for the character. And there were times that like the reason that I had to take a break was because of my sense of justice and like her being wronged by other people on the flip side of it. So like that balance kept me hooked, and I was very invested in Fleabag as a character. And I loved everything that it said. I loved, you know, the show. I loved that the structure was pretty different. Not that breaking the fourth wall is super new, but even the way that it was used here, I really enjoyed everything about it. And for context, Lainey, who has been on this podcast, for a couple episodes recently, I'm in a group chat with her. And so I knew nothing about Fleabag except for hearing about it on Twitter a little bit. And then somebody immediately took to the chat to tell Lainey that it was like a priest love story because she loves hot priests. So all I knew coming into it was that there was some sort of like priest love story going on or whatnot. So all of my expectations were, I mean, my single expectation was definitely blown out of the water, kind of. So I came with nothing, and I left very impressed. So
that's really funny, because part of why this wound up on our list in the first place is that I started watching it, and then midway through the first season, when it hit me that this was a show like in a lot of ways about grief, that like a big part of what's happening here is Fleabag processing her grief, I immediately messaged you, because that's like low key your shit. complicated explorations of grief. So inevitably, because we are us, we also had to make it content. I couldn't just be like, here, my friend, watch this show.
No, we're watching it with all of our friends now.
But I think this was many, many weeks ago, so long before you would have gone into your binge. So I understand why Hot Priest would have stood out to you as like the thing, the fundamental bit of knowledge.
Well, the funny thing is that as I was preparing for this tonight, I was thinking about the show, about, you know, this, you know, hot mess of a person, but it is a show that is ultimately about, and then I realized that you could fill that blank in with a few different things, grief being one of them. So I think maybe that the best way to tackle like all of it is to talk about a few aspects of the show, you know, this show that is ultimately about. And I want to start with Fleabag herself, because I think that there is a lot to say about the show being ultimately about an unlikable character, maybe, or somebody who mm-hmm. might be typecast as an unlikable character. Mm-hmm. You certainly get introduced to her through some pretty, you know, destructive or bad, quote unquote, behavior. So how did you guys feel about Fleabag and about her being your entry point into the story?
So fun fact about this is that my very, very first note in watching this whole thing is I kind of don't know if I like Fleabag or I hate her. And that's really refreshing, especially in the very, very, very beginning. You know, she's often described as a fuck up and just exhibits a lot of like self-destructive behavior. A lot of that, especially in the first season, less so in the second season, is very, very conscious. And that is something that I find embarrassing and kind of shocking. And like, I have a very, very difficult time watching that. For me, I loved that you had moments where she did some really messed up things, but also she had a lot of moments of sympathy, and it added to the complication of her character and how fully human and realized she is. I always felt really, really bad for her whenever any of her family kind of cast off any of her actions or her thoughts or her words as like, this is just what you're going to do. You're going to start a show. You're going to fuck up. You're going to make this all about yourself, especially in season two, because she spends so much time and energy making herself better and trying actively not to be a fuck up, as they always describe her, but they keep classifying her that way. And that's a thing that really gets me a lot. When people try and change and grow and develop more, other people around them don't see their growth or want to encourage that. So I think that this is a beautiful way to show that someone who is a fuck up like Fleabag, who is sees everything from her perspective and does things selfishly, recklessly, and self-destructively, can grow and can have these multidimensional facets of her where she cares so much for her sister and cares so much for the memory of her mother and cares so much about the memory of her friend.
Yeah, something I was thinking about with Fleabag, like especially from season one to season two, and part of the reason why I think I'm like so like in awe of season two, it takes place a year later. She's done a lot of work on herself, clearly, like both like her job and just like her like sexual relationships, kind of like in her case, she's gone to like a different extreme, but just like her approach to it has shifted a lot. Her approach to her family has clearly changed. Like they show that in the first like episode with this whole dinner scene. And I think what I thought was so interesting is that they managed to like create, I don't know if like you call it like a redemption story, but like kind of like an off-screen growth where like she still feels like herself, but different. And I was thinking about it and compared to like the Veronica Mars movie. This is like kind of a bit of a pivot, but I was thinking about Logan Eccles and how like Logan Eccles in the Veronica Mars movie, they clearly wanted him to be like this reformed bad guy character. But to me, at least, it came off almost like he like was like lobotomized because he seemed like he was better, but he didn't feel like Logan himself. Whereas I feel like this show was able to do that kind of off-screen growth without like really removing the sense of like who Fleabag is. Like she still feels messy, but she doesn't feel like quite as self-destructive in the same way as she did in season one.
Mm-hmm. The Veronica Mars example is super interesting because that is part of why I never actually watched the movie. Is it just looking at the trailer for it and then everything that I heard about it? It felt like they went in a direction that I wasn't interested in going, you know,
yeah.
In part like for that idea that, you know, we want so badly to get you to this end game of this character is better that we don't really care how we get there. We're just going to say he's better and like call it a day. Whereas I feel like the Fleabag that we meet at the beginning of season two is doing much better. She's in much better shape than the Fleabag that we spent all of season one with. But, you know, she's still like, she's still fundamentally her and she's still got issues left to resolve. And mm-hmm. so I think it walked that line really, really nicely and really beautifully. The second season, was, I don't know, particularly flawless. I think the whole thing was flawless, but the second season even more so. I really loved this character, and I loved that there are things about that first episode that feel like maybe you've seen this before, but like before it was just a like male character, but now it's a woman who's like a mess or, you know, whatever, like that kind of thing. But it ultimately moves in a direction that is very uniquely its own thing. I left it feeling like probably the moment in time that we first meet Fleabag is also not a fair representation of, you know, who she always was. Like, who she was before her mother, you know, before the death of her mother and then the death of Boo. Like, obviously she was a bit of a mess, you know, when Boo was still alive. But she was going through some shit, right? Like, we meet her at this moment where she's bottoming out, and the show gives you so much context so quickly for who she is in this moment that we are meeting her. And I just really cared so much for her, even as she was making terrible, terrible choices. I never felt like, oh no, now I hate you because you're making these bad choices. I felt like I am so stressed and I'm so worried for you. And I just want you to not make these good choices because I just want you to like be happy and like get your shit together. Yeah.
I think it's interesting because I think part of the way that they give us like a line into Fleabag and in terms of like sympathy and empathy, and then also really allow us to see that growth, even though the majority of it happens off screen, is that we get to hear her thoughts, right? And so a lot of times, even in the second season, she's still thinking things like, you know, about her bitch of a, you know, godmother or whatever, but she's behaving differently. So seeing like the continuity between her thinking like, oh, this is whatever, this is stupid, whatever, but holding back her tongue and not saying things at that first dinner that maybe in a season one she would have said, or acting in ways that shows you the growth. And I think that you get that because you have access to her thoughts, because she's addressing us directly, because the show pulls you in that way. So I really enjoyed her as a character as well. I think that they did a great job in this kind of balancing, like I said, the things that are a little more destructive with the things that are a little more easy to relate to, but also the humor with the more earnest and sincere moments. And at some of the like wildest points in this series, like the whole thing where they're at the silent retreat, and then there's like also the men are better retreat. Like, I'm sitting here thinking to myself, this is absolutely wild. This is not something that, I don't know, does this really happen? And if it does, is that what it looks like? But then at that moment, she has like an earnest sit down talk with somebody truly about her feelings. And it is one of the best moments, like heart to heart moments of the series. And the way that they kind of bring you those highs and lows of comedy and earnestness, I think just endear you to Fleabag as a whole. So yeah, I was totally in, and it made me really think about unlikable characters, like I said, because I think it's easy to pin that label, I think, especially on females who are messy or who are flawed. But I think that the show did a very good job of showing us her good sides, of showing us why she was, you know, acting out or behaving the way that she was, and kind of bringing that full circle.
I really enjoyed all of the fourth wall stuff, because that also for me falls into this category of things that could have felt like something you'd seen before, but which I ultimately think that the show did in a really novel way, and especially in the second season. And I think this was the thing that I found really interesting reading reviews, as people tried to kind of talk around it, how do we talk about the sort of fundamental major reveals of the second season without spoiling people for, you know, the way in which the second season comments on the fourth wall breaks throughout the entire show. Like, the way that the second season ends and her whole dynamic with Hot Priest is says a lot about these fourth wall breaks throughout the entire show. And there's kind of no way to talk about that without also, like, you know, saying what it is. And so I thought it was really, really interesting that we have these moments first, like when we see him starting to notice this sort of like the way in which they played with it into turning it into basically like a dissociative episode, I thought was really interesting. And then having her make the conscious choice, like when they're sleeping together, like that isn't like when she pushes the camera away, like to say, no, like I'm here, I'm going to be present in this moment. And I don't know, I just, everything about the way they used the fourth wall breaks, I thought was really, really clever. And also, in addition to being cleverly sort of written and woven in, endless props to Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who obviously, because she wrote the show for herself, like that probably helps this a ton. But the way that she jumps back and forth between, like, she's having the conversation with somebody, but she it hits like the precisely right beats to stop and steal a glance at the camera or whatever. Like, it's just, it was very, very well done and felt fresh and new in spite of being something that, you know, other shows have done this before. I felt like I had never seen it the way that I saw it on Fleabag.
And the way that the actress, like, her facial expressions turned on a dime. Mm-hmm. Like, she would smirk at us and then go straight back to looking at whoever she was talking to. And it was just delightful. Absolutely delightful. And she nailed it, like, every time. Even when, in the second season, she messes it up. Yes. And she says something to the priest that was meant for us.
Yeah.
You know, things like that were just really neat, I thought. And this obviously was something that I wanted to talk about as well, because I don't think this is a show ultimately about breaking the fourth wall, but it is a show that uses, I think, that divorced from that device, that this is a totally different show.
Yeah.
And it is a very, very big part of what the show is doing. So how did it work for you guys? How did you enjoy that, Deboki and Marianne?
I loved it. I mean, I think, like you're saying, I think this would be a really different show without that. And I think that is a big, like, it's a key part of the show. Like, it's hard to imagine enjoying it in a way, because, like, without it, it's just her acting like a mess. And, like, there's something about having her voice in there that, like, does a lot, I guess. Like, it's hard for me to imagine, like, wanting, like, feeling committed to her story, I guess, without it.
Yeah, I loved it as well. First and foremost, I think that she just delivered everything so flawlessly and effortlessly. And it was like a beautiful dance. And it wasn't just about the delivery, but it was also about, you know, all of her motions and that type of stuff when she went in and out. And I think I agree with all of you that this show just wouldn't be the same without it. And it really humanized her. And it also, one of my favorite moments about the breaking of the fourth wall is when she was in the therapist's office and therapist was asking, oh, do you have any friends? Do you have anyone to talk to? And she said, she kind of hesitated about whether or not she had friends. But then she said, oh, yeah, I do have someone to talk to, and breaks the fourth wall and mm-hmm. winks.
Yeah.
And I love that as, like, because the show kind of feels with the breaking of the fourth wall that it's not just about the gimmick of breaking up of the fourth wall. It's her internal monologue she's sharing in the same way that you would share with a very, very close friend and side with them. And, like, when your friend is messing up and making a lot of mistakes and doing some self-destructive things, but they're talking with you about it and trying to work through it with you, you have a lot of sympathy for them and you want to root for them in the same way that as an audience we're trying to root for her in the show. So I think it was just very beautifully done.
But the thing is, in this case, like, yes, but also we can't talk back, right? Like, so the only people that she's talking to is, like, she's talking to us, but we are a captive audience who are, like, watching her go on this journey, but we can never comment. Like, we can never respond mm-hmm. and we can never say, like, girl, no, stop it, you know.
So many times.
And so it is, like, that one-way communication is also very much part of it. And I think it's, you know, it's part of why, like, it ends in a way that it would be very tricky to continue from, because it's, you know, her saying, like, no, I'm done doing this. And I also think, to the point of not being able to imagine this show without it, it also goes back to the idea of Fleabag as an unlikable character that ultimately, you know, I found incredibly likable. And, like, the fourth wall breaks are a very big part of that. Like, the show is very deeply from her perspective. This is we are seeing the world through Fleabag's eyes. Obviously, it's, you know, we see everybody all at once, but the show never leaves Fleabag. There are no scenes without Fleabag. And so I think that forces that combination of factors that, you know, Fleabag being in literally every scene of the show and the fourth wall breaks, like, all of that comes together to create the space in which this show can be a story of this quote unquote unlikable character, but really actively make you root for her.
Mm-hmm. There's also something, like, reality TV about it, because she's, like, messy the way that people in reality TV are. But also, like, when you're watching most, like, reality TV shows, like, if you're watching Real Housewives, they get their confessional where they get to, like, supposedly say what they mm-hmm. really mean. And there's, like, really an element of that to, like, what she's doing.
She also reminded me of Rebecca Bunch. Mm-hmm. And there was a crazy ex-girlfriend sensibility about this, like, it. it's weird to compare because they're two completely different things. And even the humor is like very different, but something about like the concept of having this, you know, like messy female character doing or in a show that is formatted differently than what you typically see, like, and obviously my reaction, because there were so many Rebecca Noves when I was watching Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. So a lot of it like gave me flashbacks.
Well, and also finale to finale, there are additional comparisons to be made there, yeah, which I don't know. I guess that's a big Crazy Ex-Girlfriend series finale spoiler. But like, yes, the comparison persists in spite of being two very, very different shows. But also, I think the other place where that comparison comes up is that in both cases, you have star who wrote the show and like writing this thing for themselves, like this is, you know, the thing that I want to create for me, like as my own sort of vehicle, and because I am the one who can tell this very particular story about this very particular woman. So there are a ton of differences, but there are definitely other places to draw that parallel.
My next thing that I thought, and going back to what Nicole originally told me that I totally forgot she told me about the show, is that this is ultimately a show, I think, about grief. And I think it's really interesting because in that therapist's office scene, when she acknowledges us as like her friend, I think it also leans into that idea that we're watching a very specific moment in Fleabag's mm-hmm. life during the course of which she's grieving, and that this breaking of the fourth wall is almost like a coping mechanism that she's using. She doesn't have any friends. She doesn't have anybody to talk to. Obviously, the last close friend that she had, she did something very awful to. And so this really feels like a way that she is dealing with this that, I don't know, there's a lot that you could kind of extrapolate from there. But yeah, that the more that season two went on, and the more that I saw that she was doing better, but she hadn't necessarily fully digested or dealt with her grief, the more I was like, oh, this is a grief show. So
we're so happy for the grief show.
Yeah.
I know. I guess, I don't know if you guys picked up on that as well, or also there were things about like the way that the show was structured, like Nicole was saying, like there were reveals, I guess, and part of it goes hand in hand with the way that she's grieving. So it was interesting to me to also realize when I picked up on some of these things, like when I realized that she had cheated and that's why Boo was upset and had died and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the thing that tipped me off was something to do with Boo. Now I'm blanking on what specifically the moment was, but because like we learn throughout the first season, like we are gradually given pieces of the puzzle with regards to Boo. Like I think we know that Boo died in the first episode, but it takes a while to get to, like at first it was an accident, because that's how Fleabag talks about it. And you know, then we like build towards what, you know, what really happened, both in that it was intentional and also that Fleabag was a catalyst for that choice. I don't know. I am wary of the kind of language that we use around that, obviously, because, you know, mental health and suicide Fleabag is not responsible for Boo's suicide. Like that's not how that works. But it was something somewhere in that, like as we got some additional piece of information about Boo, that tipped me off that like, oh, we are gradually getting pieces of this, because this is a thing. This isn't just like something that happened. Like this is clearly something that she hasn't dealt with. And we know this because we keep seeing all of these flashbacks with Boo, who is not an actress, has been cast to play Boo on the show, but Boo is not alive during the timeline of the show. She's just there for all of these flashback sequences, but we keep having them, and they are frequently situated in moments of particular anxiety and distress for Fleabag. And I think that sort of idea that like that she is making these terrible choices in part because she hasn't processed or sifted through that trauma was another one of many things that I think was just so expertly done about this show.
Yeah, I think when I watched it, I didn't process the grief angle as much, at least the first time around. I think what I really saw it, the guilt that she seemed to be carrying. It's interesting then that the second season revolves around a Catholic priest, but like, I don't know, like, I didn't have like a specific thing that I like got from that, but I just like, that's like really the strong dominant feeling that I got from it, especially like as that related to a lot of her destructive choices. But I think for me that like that grief angle did come a little bit more strongly in the second season, because I think she has sort of like, not necessarily moved past guilt, but sort of like processed it in a way. So it's like the grief is kind of what's lingering, especially as her dad is moving on with his relationship and how that relates to her mom and stuff like that.
We started this with like the prompt of the grief question, but fully 100% agree. I think all of the exploration of like grief that's happening in the first season is happening right alongside the guilt piece of it. Like, you can't disentangle those two things in season one. Whereas in season two, it's that's like part of what has changed in the intervening year, is that she has sorted through a lot of the guilt, but, you know, maybe still needs to handle the grief pieces.
Yeah. I loved how in season two, I agree that in season one, it's very much a entanglement of guilt and grief. Whereas in season two, presumably after a year and some change, she's accepted her guilt and trying to move forward, but that grief is still there. It's still lingering. And I love that in season two, it wasn't just the grief over Boo's passing, but it was also bringing up a lot with her mom as well. Like, I felt season two had way more of both than just the one. And it really allowed for having that conversation that the grief is always going to be there. It'll just be lighter or subdued in certain situations, and then in other situations it'll get more aggravated. And even in moments where you least expect it, she would have flashes of Boo in the second season that were kind of surprising, and that's just what grief does a lot of the time.
I think it was really interesting the way that her grief over her mom and over Boo were layered. And one of the moments that I think was most memorable to me, or that felt like a plot reveal, which was really interesting because it wasn't really like a plot reveal, but that moment when she's grieving the loss of her mother and saying, what do I do with all this love that I have for her? Which, one, is like a really poignant grief thing to say, and I felt that. And then like Boo is being an amazing friend and saying, give it all to me, you know. And so to think about the idea that she really invested probably even more in this friendship with Boo after the passing of her mom, and then to lose Boo as well, I thought was like a really, I don't know, it made you feel for like the complexity of everything that she was going through.
A thing that I especially love in the second season is how much Claire becomes like how much of their relationship becomes center stage, because I feel like that's like where she's learning to like place a lot of her love. The priest is like this romantic plot, but she's also like working on like the love that she has for her family. And she and Claire have had this relationship that's been super fraught, but in the end of last season was like basically kind of, it seemed cut off. And just seeing like from the first episode how she like immediately protects her sister, and how over the course of the season they kind of regain trust, and she actually like helps her sister kind of maybe make a better marital choice. I loved how much of that was center stage, especially kind of in relation to that like romantic subplot. I love that Claire was the one who got like the dramatic rom-com ending, even if it's off screen. It's not always about Fleabag. Like, she, like, that's still a happy ending for Fleabag, even if her own like love story that she wanted to like go a certain way didn't actually go that way. Like, it's still a happy ending for her.
I also really loved watching Claire and Fleabag's relationship mend and grow. And in particular, that the line at the wedding where Claire and Fleabag are talking, and Fleabag's trying to convince Claire to go, and Claire tells her that the only person she'd run through an airport for is her. Oh, my heart. Yeah. My heart. The sister feels.
Yeah. Well, I think that this is a show that is also ultimately about family. And I think that it's...
Let's go.
I think it's interesting to see the way that her family contextualizes some of her messiness, specifically in the way that her dad is so bad at communicating. And I mean, Claire is as well. And sometimes I feel like I lost sight of Fleabag being bad at communicating because she communicates so directly to us mm-hmm. and so openly. Mm-hmm. But there were a few times where, like, especially with the priest, where he would just be asking her questions and she would completely clam up. Mm-hmm. And you understand why. Like, nobody wants to be like, yeah, I cheated on, you know, my best friend with my best friend's boyfriend or whatever. That's like a really deep thing. But the way that she would clam up made me really realize that this is a family of really bad communicators. What did you think about the rest of her family and kind of what they brought to the story and the table?
So both the actress who plays Claire, whose name I'm forgetting, but and Olivia Colman are nominated for Emmys for their performance in this second season. For the second season especially, the actress who plays Claire does so much in terms of, I think, highlighting that the difference between these two women and how they carry themselves and how they move through the world. And like, you see it in that, like, now that Fleabag is getting better, she is able to be a better sister and she is able to be more supportive of her sister. Obviously, like, she still, you know, fucks up and still makes mistakes in addition to being better. But you see kind of the balance and the ways in which they are different, but also that those differences sort of complement each other. So I really enjoyed everything that Claire brings to the story. In the first season, she's a lot of what she is there for is that she is a mirror for Fleabag's self-loathing. Like, she looks at Claire and, you know, sees everything she can't be to a certain extent, you know. And then in the second season, when she is much healthier, it's a place where she can pour all that love, right? Like, this is one of the things that I can do with that. And I really, really enjoyed the dynamic between the two of them. There's a whole separate conversation about the godmother, but the father is just kind of, I don't know, he's there. I think he is also a really good character. He was so frustrating to watch because he's just like very bad at communicating and like also is just like mad at Fleabag, and I just want him to be a better dad. Claire I understood and felt for even as she was doing things that upset me. I understood her more than I understood the dad. I was often just like, nah, man, why are you doing this?
I think the dad, weirdly, though, is also where I started to understand a little bit more of the grief kind of ideas that this mm-hmm. like the show is going for, because, like, I mean, I don't know if we have a separate section for the godmother, but, like, just in case, like, she's terrible, right? And, like,
go for it.
And, like, when we see her in the funeral, that, like, for Fleabag's mom, that, like, even he finds her annoying, I was like, oh, like, he's lonely. That's that relationship, and that's why he's not going to ever, like, leave that relationship, because whatever the issues of the godmother aside, like, she can't even remember his name. And, like, I don't know if that was just to, like, kind of poke fun at the fact that, like, we don't really know most of these characters' names. But, like, she also does seem like she would not remember his name. All of that aside, like, he at least has a companion, and that is clearly a part of the grief that he is working on, and that Fleabag is also dealing with, like, kind of that loneliness. So
yeah, I actually kind of like the dad in a weird way. And I think that this kind of fits into my thoughts on how this is just like a family that is dealing with grief, and the way that they're dealing with it is often in direct contrast with one another. And so it kind of creates this, like, dissonance where they're not communicating well and they're not really understanding each other because they're all coming up at it from different perspectives. Like, I feel like the dad is very much, like, trying to fill that loneliness that he knows he never can. And Fleabag is, especially in season one, and a little bit even creeping into season two, but not as much. Obviously, we already discussed this, is it's manifesting itself through self-destruction and, like, a certain level of, like, what's the point of this? This is kind of where I got from her. And then Claire seems that her method of grieving is just trying her hardest to keep everything together and prevent anything from falling apart in her life. And it's more of control based. And these different aspects are in conflict with one another throughout. But then in the second season, and as you progress, they learn about each other's method and kind of understand it in a new way. And I think that one of the things I like the most about the dynamic between Fleabag and Claire in the second season is that they start to understand each other and kind of adopt each other's method of existing to a teeny tiny bit where Claire just runs off her male Claire to the airport and just does a thing that Fleabag would do. And Fleabag, on the flip side, holds everything together and accepts the fact that her priest boyfriend that she loves can't love her back and decides to go back to the priesthood, and she just accepts it and moves forward. And I think that strengthens their friendship as sisters as well, mm-hmm. which I just absolutely love. I love sister relationships and dynamics in all media because I have a sister and I just love it.
Same. And I especially really liked seeing, even when they were at odds or when Claire was kind of not pretending, but kind of pretending that she didn't find Fleabag funny and things like that, the way that they, I don't know, bantered and they played off of one another, it was really interesting for me to watch, because a lot of times sisters are different, but there is a shared experience there that you really can't escape. And at the end of the day, when Claire needed somebody, you know, Fleabag faked a whole miscarriage for her and Fleabag took her to the hospital and things like that. So Fleabag was really there for her sister. I think it's really interesting that you mentioned like their different methods of coping with grief, and the way that Claire was like super controlled or controlling over everything. And on the opposite end of that, you had Fleabag, who was basically just letting everything go to ruin, right? She was letting go of everything, making bad decisions. And somewhere in the middle, their father was being strung along. Like, he feels very passive in his environment. Like, he's mm-hmm. just kind of there for the ride that the godmother is taking him on. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, that idea of, even though you share grief, you all grieve in different ways, I think is very well highlighted by this group of people.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also the godmother is the worst.
Yes.
I'd argue that Claire's husband is actually the worst.
Yeah.
The godmother is second worst.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But it's a close second.
She's a very close second, though.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
I love that even his attempt at a redemption speech or whatever is basically like, I'm a douchebag. I suck. But like, I don't know. I can't help that I suck. Like, that's his whole speech. It was great. It was so good. I was stressed too as he was giving it that Claire was going to stay. I was like, oh no, is this going to work? And then it didn't. And I was happy. But he is definitely the true worst, with the godmother being a very close second, but so well done. Like, she sucks, but she's such a great character, both in the way that she is written and in the way that Olivia Colman plays her. Like, she is great. she's terrible, but she's great.
When she was first introduced, I remember, like, because, like, I think in the first episode, Fleabag is like, this is my godmother, she's the worst, or something like that. And then the godmother is just, seems like super sweet. And I thought that we were supposed to be getting that, like, Fleabag completely assumes the worst in other people. And then, of course, a few moments later, or maybe later in the episode or the next episode, I was like, oh, okay, no, she's actually awful. But, like, even that element to it, I thought was, like, so great, where, like, there was, like, that little moment where it was like, oh, maybe this is Fleabag. Nope, this is her. Like,
well, and we see that at the funeral too, where the godmother is first kind of moving in on their dad, literally at her friend's funeral. Yeah. And Fleabag sees it, but Claire is like, no, why are you assuming the worst in people? But No, Fleabag just sees her the most clearly.
Yeah. I had that same exact experience of, like, her being like, oh, my godmother's the worst. And the first thing that you see her doing is, like, a fake smile and, like, a little passive-aggressive thing. Whereas, like, and she gives us a look, Fleabag does, directly to the camera. And I'm just like, oh, come on, that wasn't that bad. Yeah. But yes, every, like, following thing that the godmother does is so bad. Yeah. And then you really just start to realize. And, I mean, I think there's a few moments where kind of like that facade breaks and where you really see like the person underneath and at her, what is it, the sexhibition or whatnot, where her dad storms off and she was like, I'm sorry you had to hear that, but you had to. And you kind of see like who she truly is. I'm just like, oh man, you are definitely the second worst, but it's a really bad worst.
Yeah.
I think like part of the reason she seems like the worst is because she's the worst in so many different ways. Like, Martin is just the worst, but like in pretty much like a one standard, like almost one note kind of way.
Yeah.
Which is like, I almost didn't like the character because he is so one note compared to like everybody else in the show, but I think it also works. Whereas like the godmother is like, she finds new and creative ways to be terrible, like in every episode. Like it's
remarkable.
I love during the wedding sequence when she is introducing all of her friends and she's just like, it's basically her talking about a collection, right? Yeah. Like, here are the humans that I've collected. This one is gay. This one is, I forget what they were all were, but they were all like, each one was a unique and different special, like.
Bisexual refugee. Like,
yeah.
I thought it was really interesting that by the end, though, the godmother basically tells her, like, yeah, like, you don't like me, that's fine. But also, I'm pretty sure you don't want to take care of your father for the, like, upcoming years. Or, you know, like, it'd be easier to just let him have this. And that was so, I don't know, that was, like, such a reality check, too, of being like, you know what? If her father is happy, which who knows because he doesn't talk, like, let him have it. Like, you know, it is what it is. There are people in your life you don't like that you just have to deal with. And I think that that is part of what Fleabag probably has to learn is how to navigate that relationship without, you know, throwing wine glasses to the floor every time that she has to.
Yep. While we're talking about characters, I just, like, really briefly feel that we have to acknowledge Hot Priest.
Okay. I was a little worried.
In our,
I didn't know if I was going to have to ask about Hot Priest.
Our tour of characters. I also, Hot Priest was on the short list of things that I knew about the show going into it because I watched the two seasons all together and I, like, saw that happening on Twitter that the weekend that season two came out, Twitter was really into Hot Priest as like a thing. I was like, I don't really know where we're going with this.
It was jumpsuit and Hot Priest.
That was like that weekend on Twitter. And, you know, it was like a really fun time. Fanfic writers like had a blast because they were like, oh, hey, there's like AO3 tags. I hear you love Hot Priest now. I got you, you know, whatever. And like, I left it, I finished it feeling like, oh, I get it. Like, I get, yes, 100%. I'm sad that I missed this moment on Twitter because, yes, I also love Hot Priest and I'm really sad. Like, it was correct. It was the right ending, but also I'm really sad about it.
Yeah.
For sure. I think that more like he was Hot Priest and also kind of cool priest.
Yes. You know,
he was drinking and swearing. But then he was also like, nerdy, cute priest with a fear of foxes.
I read somewhere that Phoebe Waller-Bridge always intended for Andrew Scott to play this role, basically because, as she describes it, he had the charisma of 10 people in one. And I'm like, yes. That's correct.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about the character of Hot Priest. Well, the priest, as he is titled in the actual series.
Yes.
But I don't think that anyone other than Andrew Scott could have played him because, like, any other actor might have taken it into a way that's, like, a little too creepy or a little too slimy or, like, a little too pious or something. And he was just, like, he was hitting it right perfectly where it should be hit. Like, every single line, every single delivery, everything that he did was just, like, absolutely perfect. I love it.
And like Mari was saying, all of the different and distinct ways in which he was charming. Like, there were so many different things going on at once that were making, like combined to make him so incredibly endearing.
I would fall in love with that priest too.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Yeah.
It's no coincidence that the internet also loves Moriarty from Sherlock.
It was interesting. This is like a, I don't know, small production quibble. So the actor is at least 2 inches officially. Like, he is 5'8", she's 5'10". Honestly, I think that's a generous 5'8". And like, sometimes they would, you know, just like let them be their actual heights. But then every now and then it was clear that they had given him like lifts for his shoes. But they weren't doing it all the time. So like in the scene in her living room when they kiss right before they have sex, they're like the same height. And like, this is not, look, we know you're not the same height. We've established this already in other shots. So I don't know why you're doing this to me now. And I was slightly distracted by that.
Yeah, it was weird because like, I feel like the confessional scene where they like kiss for the first time, when I saw it the first time, I was like both very into it, but also really uncomfortable with it because it's like this weird
power dichotomy where she's just like literally poured out all of her feelings onto him. And like the way the trajectory of that scene, I feel like was like really tricky. And I feel like it only could work in the exact way that they did it with the people they did it with. I always feel like kind of conflicted when I think about that scene, but like, I feel like it worked in a really weird, specific way.
Yeah, not gonna lie. The first thought I had when he opened her confessional door was like, oh, he's gonna murder her. But
yeah,
seriously.
That didn't happen, so yeah. That's good. Turned out way better.
The way he was like backlit, and it had a very creepy vibe. And then I was like, oh, okay, they're kissing. I see.
When I was rewatching, I feel like I processed so much more of how dysfunctional his own upbringing was. Like, the first time around, it's like, oh, right, he has like a pedophile brother. But like, you don't really know that much about him. But the few facts we get about his background, I think, play into his internal conflict. Like, his parents are like, I think he mentions that they're alcoholics and that he doesn't have a good relationship with them. He mentions like, I've sacrificed a lot for this life. And he never talks about what it is. But like, he has clearly this like very fraught family history. And I thought it was interesting that they didn't really go that much into it, but like, I like the way that that kind of ties into why he would be so conflicted about this choice that he has to make between Fleabag and this calling that he's worked so hard for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think part of what is playing out in that relationship too is that these are two people who are in a lot of ways like similarly damaged. Obviously, we don't know that much about his damage, and what we do know is its sources are different, but also like the actual damage itself somehow is very, very similar, but they've found very different ways of processing it, and that is part of like what it is kind of playing out in their interactions, is that they are kind of tugging at the edges of what the other person is doing in terms of like how they, you know, deal with being a person, just like how they move through the world. And so, yes, I think the show does a really good job of making it still Fleabag's story. So we don't actually get all the details of what is going on with Hot Priest, but for sure, Hot Priest has a really fucked up past.
Yeah. Well, on that same like train of thought, how did you guys feel about this ending and the way that we get kind of closure and the way that it's kind of accepted that this is the end for the series? Were you guys satisfied with that?
I was. I think it's a credit to the show that it ended with me feeling like I want more, like I want more of this story, but also I feel that feels like a really good place for it to end, and I appreciate for the show to get to end on such a perfect note, that it gets to end having had, you know, 12 really wonderful episodes and end in a way that feels conclusive, that feels like this is the end of this chapter of the story. I thought about this a lot when we were talking about The Americans. Obviously, that's 75 episodes as opposed to 12. But like, it's very clear that there are reasons for why we drop in where we do and out where we do, like why that section of time in these two characters' lives is the section of time that we are following for this story. And I think the combination of, you know, sort of narrative conceits like the fourth wall breaking and whatever, and everything that we know about these kind of bookends, like this feels like the right section of Fleabag's life for the story to have followed. And now I feel like Fleabag is off living a much better and healthier and like maybe less dramatically interesting life, right? And like, I love that for her. Congratulations.
I agree with all of that with my head, but in my heart, I'm like, boo, I want more. It was too short. It was too short of a story. Like, I would watch this character be less dramatically interesting because of the, like, I don't know, just hearing her thoughts. And I think this story had like a lot of different things playing, and even the like more day-to-day humor, like you got a bad haircut, or you know, things like that, like those things were hilarious to me. And so I don't know, I feel like they could have kept going and I would have kept watching. I understand why they ended on this really wonderful and perfect note, and I understand why she couldn't be with Hot Priest and all of that, but still, my feelings don't agree.
This is the kind of thing that is perfect for fanfic though, like, right? Like, let other people will go write the wonderful fanfic in which Hot Priest and Fleabag stay together and whatever. Like, that's fine.
And Claire and Claire get together and have beautiful Claire children.
There's this article out in Vulture that's all about this, what the symbolism of the fox at the end means. And the author of this article seeks out her dad, who is a Catholic and also a retired English professor who specialized in Renaissance English. And he was like, apparently he saw the ending and was like, no, that symbol means that they end up together. Like, the use of that fox is a sign that they end up together. And I am both accepting the ending as what it is, but I'm also accepting this alternate universe version of the show where, like, this Vulture writer's dad is correct and like the symbolism means that they end up together. Like, I went through high school English for this. Like, this is what I learned symbolism for.
Yes.
She is the fox. She followed him in the end. She's been there all along.
Great. Perfect.
I agree with Nicole a little. I do like the ending, and I think that as much as I love the characters and as much as we just talked about fan fiction where we would want to see where the characters end up, I love that this is such a self-contained story, and it feels a lot like Fleabag doesn't need us anymore, so she has a different way to cope and she can move on, and it's kind of what's best for her, for us to let her go.
Yeah.
And I kind of like that.
Yes, totally.
As much as we want the fan fiction and to watch these characters just keep going.
Right. We can go write that ourselves. Phoebe Waller-Bridge has to go write a Bond movie. Like, she's got other shit to do.
Yeah. It's like a plot Bond movie, like probably like 50 other TV shows. She's got enough on her plate. Yeah.
And I'm excited to like consume all of the other things that she creates, but also keep rewatching Fleabag. Like, this is the other thing, because it's only 12 short episodes. I can rewatch this so many times.
Mm-hmm. Like, when I watched season one, like, it was before season two. Like, I don't think I knew that like there was going to be a season two at the time. And like, I watched it and I was like, okay, this is perfect. It's ended perfectly. There does not need to be another season. And then I saw that there was going to be another season. And I was like, well, that's weird. I can't imagine like where they're going to go with this. So like, I feel like if there was like a surprise, hey, we're going to do a season three, I would have the same reaction of like, we don't need this. But I would be so curious about where it would go. Like, I feel like I almost want it more just to see what it would look like than because, like, I want more out of this specific story, like, from directly from her.
100%. I will watch the shit out of any additional seasons.
Same.
That the show gives me. Even as I feel satisfied with this conclusion, I'm here for any additional content.
And that brings us to the end of this content. Thank you to Marianne and Voki for joining us this week, and thank you all for listening. We'd love to hear all of your thoughts on Fleabag. There will be a post dedicated to this episode up on snarksquad.com. You can also sign up to join our community on Patreon at patreon.com/snarksquad. You can also find us on Twitter at snark_squad. You can find me at my name is Marines.
I am at Sweeney Says.
I am at MF Des Silva.
And I am at okidoki_boki.
Thank you, as always, to Stefan Chin for the theme music that is playing us out right now. And we will be back in your feed next week. Bye.